or shall I have him chastise you again?" Sansa's ear felt numb. She touched it, and her fingertips came away wet and red.
As you command, my lord."
"Your grace," Joffrey corrected her, "I shall look for you in court." He turned and left. Sir Meryn and Sir Aerys followed him out, but Sandok again lingered long enough to yank her roughly to her feet. "Save yourself some pain, girl, and give him what he wants."
What does he want? Please tell me."
"He wants you to smile, and smell sweet, and be his lady love," the hound rasped. "He wants to hear you recite all your pretty little words the way the scepter taught you. He wants you to love him, and fear him."
After he was gone, Sansa sank back onto the rushes, staring at the wall until two of her bedmaids crept timidly into the chamber. "I will need hot water for my bath, please," she told them, "and perfume, and some powder to hide this bruise." The right side of her face was swollen and beginning to ache, but she knew Joffrey would want her to be beautiful. The hot water made her think of Winterfell, and she took strength from that. She had not washed since the day her father died, and she was startled at how filthy the water became. Her maids sluiced the blood off her face, scrubbed the dirt from her back, washed her hair, and brushed it out, until it sprang back in thick auburn curls. Sansa did not speak to them, except to give them commands. They were Lannister servants, not her own, and she did not trust them. When the time came to dress, she chose the green silk gown that she had worn to the tourney. She recalled how gallant Joff had been to her that night at the feast. Perhaps it would make him remember as well, and treat her more gently. She drank a glass of buttermilk and nibbled at some sweet biscuits as she waited to settle her stomach. It was midday when Sir Meryn returned. He had donned his white armour, a shirt of enamel scales chased with gold, a tall helm with a golden sunburst crest, greaves and gorget and gauntlet and boots of gleaming plate, a heavy wool cloak clasped with a golden lion. His visor had been removed from his helm, to better show his dour face, pouchy bags under his eyes, a wide, sour mouth, rusty hair spotted with grey.
"My lady," he said, bowing, as if he had not beaten her bloody only 3 hours past, "his grace has instructed me to escort you to the throne room."
"Did he instruct you to hit me if I refuse to come?"
"Are you refusing to come, my lady?"
The look he gave her was without expression. He did not so much as glance at the bruise he had left her. He did not hate her, Sansa realized. Neither did he love her. He felt nothing for her at all. She was only a thing to him. "No," she said, rising. She wanted to rage, to hurt him, as he'd hurt her, to warn him that when she was queen, she would have him exiled if he ever dared strike her again. But she remembered what the hound had told her, so all she said was, "I shall do whatever his grace commands."
"As I do," he replied.
"Yes, but you are no true knight, Sir Meryn." Sandor Clegane would have laughed at that, Sansa knew. Other men might have cursed her, warned her to keep silent, even beg for her forgiveness. Sir Meryn Trant did none of these. Sir Meryn Trant simply did not care. The balcony was deserted save for Sansa. She stood with her head bowed, fighting to hold back her tears, while below Joffrey sat on his iron throne and dispensed what it pleased him to call justice.
9 cases out of 10 seemed to bore him. Those he allowed his counsel to handle, squirming restlessly while Lord Baelish, Grand Maester Pycelle, or Queen Cersei resolved the matter. When he did choose to make a ruling, though, not even his Queen Mother could sway him. A thief was brought before him, and he had Sir Ilion chop his hand off, right there in court. 2 knights came to him with a dispute about some land, and he decreed that they should duel for it on the morrow.
"To the death," he added.
A woman fell to her knees to plead for the head of a man executed as a traitor. She had loved him, she said, and she wanted to see him decently buried.
"If you loved a traitor, you must be a traitor too," Joffrey said.
Two gold cloaks dragged her off to the dungeons. Frog-faced Lord Slint sat at the end of the council table, wearing a black velvet doublet and a shiny cloth of gold cape, nodding with approval every time the king pronounced a sentence. Sansa stared hard at his ugly face, remembering how he had thrown down her father for Sir Ilion to behead, wishing she could hurt him, wishing that some hero would throw him down and cut off his head. But a voice inside her whispered, "There are no heroes." And she remembered what Lord Petar had said to her here in this very hall. "Life is not a song, sweetling," he told her. "You may learn that one day, to your sorrow." "In life, the monsters win," she told herself. And now it was a hound's voice. She heard a cold rasp, metal on stone.
"Save yourself some pain, girl, and give him what he wants."
The last case was a plump tavern singer, accused of making a song that ridiculed the late King Robert. Joff commanded them to fetch his wood harp and ordered him to perform the song for the court. The singer wept and swore he would never sing that song again, but the king insisted. It was sort of a funny song, all about Robert fighting with a pig. The pig was the boar who'd killed him, Sansa knew, but in some verses it almost sounded as if he were singing about the queen. When the song was done, Joffrey announced that he'd decided to be merciful. The singer could keep either his fingers or his tongue. He would have a day to make his choice. Janus Slint nodded. That was the final business of the afternoon, Sansa saw with relief. But her ordeal was not yet done. When the herald's voice dismissed the court, she fled the balcony, only to find Joffrey waiting for her at the base of the curving stairs. The hound was with him, and Sir Meron as well. The young king examined her critically, top to bottom.
"You look much better than you did."
"Thank you, Your Grace," Sansa said. Hollow words, but they made him nod and smile.
"Walk with me,"
Joffrey commanded, offering her his arm. She had no choice but to take it. The touch of his hand would have thrilled her once. Now it made her flesh crawl.
"My name day will be here soon," Joffrey said, as they slipped out the rear of the throne room. "There will be a great feast and gifts. What are you going to give me?"
I had not thought, my lord."
"Your Grace," he said sharply, "you truly are a stupid girl, aren't you? My mother says so."
"She does?" After all that had happened, his words should have lost their power to hurt her, yet somehow they had not. The queen had always been so kind to her.
"Oh, yes, she worries about our children, whether they'll be stupid like you. But I told her not to trouble herself."
The king gestured, and Sir Meron opened the door for them. "Thank you, Your Grace," she murmured. "The hound was right," she thought. "I am only a little bird repeating the words they taught me." The sun had fallen below the western wall, and the stones of the Red Keep glowed dark as blood.
"I'll get you with child as soon as you're able," Joffrey said, as he escorted her across the practice yard. "If the first one is stupid, I'll chop off your head and find a smarter wife. When do you think you'll be able to have children?"
Sansa could not look at him. He shamed her so. "Septo Mordain says most high-born girls have their flowering at 12 or 13. Joffrey nodded.
"This way."
He led her into the gatehouse, to the base of the steps that led up to the battlements. Sansa jerked back away from him, trembling. Suddenly she knew where they were going.
"No,"
she said, her voice a frightened gasp.
"Please, no, don't make me. I beg you." Joffrey pressed his lips together. I want to show you what happens to traitors.
Sansa shook her head wildly.
I won't. I won't.
I can have Sir Meryn drag you up, he said. You won't like that. You'd better do what I say.
Joffrey reached for her, and Sansa cringed away from him, backing into the Hound.
Do it, girl,
Sandor Clegane told her, pushing her back toward the king. His mouth twitched on the burned side of his face, and Sansa could almost hear the rest of it.
He'll have you up there, no matter what. So give him what he wants.
She forced herself to take King Joffrey's hand. The climb was something out of a nightmare. Every step was a struggle, as if she were pulling her feet out of ankle-deep mud. And there were more steps than she would have believed, a thousand, thousand steps, and horror waiting on the ramparts. From the high battlements of the gatehouse, the whole world spread out below them. Sansa could see the great sept of Baelor on Visenya's hill, where her father had died. At the other end of the Street of the Sisters stood the fire-blackened ruins of the Dragon Pit. To the west, the swollen red sun was half hidden behind the Gate of the Gods. The Salt Sea was at her back, and to the south was the fish market and the docks, and the swirling torrent of the Blackwater Rush. And to the north, she turned that way, and saw only the city, streets and alleys and hills and bottoms, and more streets and more alleys, and the stone of distant walls. Yet she knew that beyond them was open country, farms and fields and forests, and beyond that, north and north and north again, stood Winterfell.
"What are you looking at?" Joffrey said. "This is what I wanted you to see, right here."
A thick stone parapet protected the outer ridge of the rampart, reaching as high as Sansa's chin, with crenellations cut into it every 5 feet for archers. The heads were mounted between the crenels, along the top of the wall, impaled on iron spikes, so they faced out over the city. Sansa had noted them the moment she stepped out onto the wall walk, but the river and the bustling streets and the setting sun were ever so much prettier. "He can make me look at the heads," she told herself, "but he can't make me see them."
"This one is your father," he said. "This one here. Dog, turn it around so she can see him."
Sandor Clegane took the head by the hair and turned it. The severed head had been dipped in tar to preserve it longer. Sansa looked at it calmly, not seeing it at all. It did not really look like Lord Eddard, she thought. It did not even look real. "How long do I have to look?" Joffrey seemed disappointed.
"Do you want to see the rest?"
There was a long row of them. "If it please, Your Grace." Joffrey marched her down the wall walk, past a dozen more heads and two empty spikes.
"I'm saving those for my Uncle Stannis and my Uncle Renly," he explained.
The other heads had been dead and mounted much longer than her father. Despite the tar, most were long past being recognizable. The king pointed to one and said, "That's your scepter there." But Sansa could not even have told that it was a woman. The jaw had rotted off her face, and birds had eaten one ear and most of a cheek. Sansa had wondered what had happened to Septa Mordaine, although she supposed she had known all along. "Why did you kill her?" she asked. "She was Godsworn."
"She was a traitor."
Joffrey looked pouty. Somehow, she was upsetting him.
"You haven't said what you mean to give me for my name day. Maybe I should give you something instead. Would you like that?"
"If it please you, my lord," Sansa said. When he smiled, she knew he was mocking her.
"Your brother is a traitor too, you know."
He turned Septa Mordaine's head back around.
"I remember your brother from Winterfell. My dog called him the Lord of the Wooden Sword. Didn't you, dog?"
"Did I?"
the Hound replied.
"I don't recall."
Joffrey gave
a petulant shrug. "Your brother defeated my Uncle Jamie. My mother says it was treachery and deceit. She wept when she heard. Women are all weak, even her, though she pretends she isn't. She says we need to stay in King's Landing in case my other uncles attack. But I don't care. After my name day feast, I'm going to raise a host and kill your brother myself. That's what I'll give you, Lady Sansa, your brother's head."
A kind of madness took over her then, and she heard herself say, "Maybe my brother will give me your head." Joffrey scowled.
"You must never mock me like that. A true wife does not mock her lord. Sir Meryn, teach her."
This time the knight grasped her beneath the jaw and held her head still as he struck her. He hit her twice, left to right and harder right to left. Her lip split and blood ran down her chin to mingle with the salt of her tears.
"You shouldn't be crying all the time," Joffrey told her. "You're more pretty when you smile and laugh."
Sansa made herself smile, afraid that he would have Sir Meryn hit her again if she did not. But it was no good. The king still shook his head.
"Wipe off the blood, you're all messy."
The outer parapet came up to her chin, but along the inner edge of the walk was nothing. Nothing but a long plunge to the bailey 70 or 80 feet below. All it would take was a shove, she told herself. He was standing right there, smirking at her with those fat worm lips.
"You could do it," she told herself. "You could do it right now. It wouldn't even matter if she went over with him. It wouldn't matter at all."
"Here, girl." Sandor Clegane knelt before her, between her and Joffrey. With a delicacy surprising in such a big man, he dabbed at the blood welling from her broken lip. The moment was gone. Sansa lowered her eyes. "Thank you," she said when he was done. She was a good girl, and always remembered her courtesies.
Daenerys. Wings shadowed her fevered dreams.
"You don't want to wake the dragon, do you?"
She was walking down a long hall beneath high stone arches. She could not look behind her, must not look behind her. There was a door ahead of her, tiny with distance, but even from afar she saw it was painted red. She walked faster, and her bare feet left bloody footprints on the stone.
"You don't want to wake the dragon, do you?"
She saw sunlight on the Dothraki Sea, the living plain, rich with smells of earth and death. Wind stirred the grasses, and they rippled like water. Drogo held her in strong arms, and his hand stroked her sex, and opened her, and woke that sweet wetness that was his alone. And the stars smiled down at them, stars in a daylight sky.
"Home," she whispered, as he entered her and filled her with his seed.
But suddenly the stars were gone, and across the blue sky swept the great wings, and the world took flame.
"Don't want to wake the dragon, do you?"
Ser Jorah's face was drawn and sorrowful.
"Rhaegar was the last dragon," he told her.
He warmed translucent hands over a glowing brazier where stone eggs smoldered red as coals. One moment he was there, and the next he was fading, his flesh colourless, less substantial than the wind.
"The last dragon,"
he whispered, thin as a wisp, and was gone. She felt the dark behind her, and the red door seemed farther away than ever.
"Don't want to wake the dragon, do you?"
Viserys stood before her, screaming.
"The dragon does not beg, slut! You do not command the dragon. I am the dragon, and I will be crowned."
The molten gold trickled down his face like wax, burning deep channels in his flesh.
I am the dragon, and I will be crowned, he shrieked, and his fingers snapped like snakes, biting at her nipples, pinching, twisting, even as his eyes burst and ran like jelly down seared and blackened cheeks.
Don't want to wake the dragon.
The red door was so far ahead of her, and she could feel the icy breath behind, sweeping up on her. If it caught her, she would die a death that was more than death. Howling forever alone in the darkness, she began to run.
Don't want to wake the dragon.
She could feel the heat inside her, a terrible burning in her womb. Her son was tall and proud, with Drogo's copper skin and her own silver-gold hair, violet eyes shaped like almonds. And he smiled for her, and began to lift his hand toward hers. But when he opened his mouth, the fire poured out. She saw his heart burning through his chest, and in an instant he was gone, consumed like a moth by a candle, turned to ash. She wept for her child, the promise of a sweet mouth on her breast, but her tears turned to steam as they touched her skin.
Want to wake the dragon?
Ghosts lined the hallway, dressed in the faded raiment of kings. In their hands were swords of pale fire. They had hair of silver, and hair of gold, and hair of platinum white, and their eyes were opal and amethyst, tourmaline and jade.
Faster, they cried. Faster, faster!
She raised her feet, melting the stone wherever they touched.
Faster!
The ghost cried as one, and she screamed and threw herself forward. A great knife of pain ripped down her back, and she felt her skin tear open, and smelled the stench of burning blood, and saw the shadow of wings. And Daenerys Targaryen flew.
Wake the dragon.
The door loomed before her, the red door so close, so close. The hall was a blur around her, the coal receding behind. And now the stone was gone. And she flew across the Dothraki Sea, high and higher, the green rippling beneath. And all that lived and breathed fled in terror from the shadow of her wings. She could smell home. She could see it, there, just beyond that door, green fields and great stone houses and arms to keep her warm there. She threw open the door.
The dragon.
And saw her brother Rhaegar, mounted on a stallion as black as his armor. Fire glimmered red through the narrow eye-slit of his helm.
"The last dragon,"
Ser Jorah's voice whispered faintly.
"The last. The last."
Danny lifted his polished black visor. The face within was her own. After that, for a long time there was only pain, the fire within her, and the whispering of stars. She woke to the taste of ashes.
No, she moaned. No, please.
Khaleesi, Jiqui hovered over her, a frightened doe. The tent was drenched in shadow, still and close. Flakes of ash drifted upward from a brazier, and Danny followed them, with her eyes through the smoke hole above.
Flying, she thought. I had wings. I was flying.
But it was only a dream.
Help me,
she whispered, struggling to rise.
Bring me.
Her voice was raw as a wound, and she could not think what she wanted.
Why did she hurt so much?
It was as if her body had been torn to pieces and remade from the scraps.
I want...
Yes, Khaleesi. Quick as that, Jiqui was gone, bolting from the tent, shouting. Danny needed something, someone, what? It was important, she knew. It was the only thing in the world that mattered. She rolled onto her side and got an elbow under her, fighting the blanket tangled about her legs. It was so hard to move. The world swam dizzily.
I have to.
They found her on the carpet, crawling toward her dragon eggs. Ser Jorah Mormont
lifted her in his arms and carried her back to her sleeping silks, while she struggled feebly against him. Over his shoulder she saw her three handmaids, Jogo, with his little wisp of moustache, and the flat, broad face of Miramar's door.
"I must," she tried to tell them. "I have to."
"Sleep, princess,"
Sir Jorah said.
"No," Danny said. "Please, please."
"Yes."
He covered her with silk, though she was burning.
"Sleep and grow strong again. Khaleesi, come back to us."
And then Miramar's door was there, the Meiji, tipping a cup against her lips. She tasted sour milk and something else, something thick and bitter. Warm liquid ran down her chin. Somehow she swallowed. The tent grew dimmer, and sleep took her again. This time she did not dream. She floated, serene and at peace, on a black sea that knew no shore. After a time, a night, a day, a year, she could not say, she woke again. The tent was dark, its silken walls flapping like wings when the wind gusted outside. This time, Danny did not attempt to rise. "Ire," she called. "Jiqui, Doria." They were there at once. "My throat is dry," she said, "so dry." And they brought her water. It was warm and flat, yet Danny drank it eagerly and sent Jiqui for more. Ire dampened a soft cloth and stroked her brow. "I have been sick," Danny said. The Dothraki girl nodded. "How long?" The cloth was soothing, but Ire seemed so sad it frightened her.
"Long," she whispered.
When Jiqui returned with more water, Miramar's door came with her, eyes heavy from sleep.
"Drink,"
she said, lifting Danny's head to the cup once more, but this time it was only wine. Sweet, sweet wine. Danny drank and lay back, listening to the soft sounds of her own breathing. She could feel the heaviness in her limbs, as sleep crept in and filled her up once more.
"Bring me," she murmured, her voice slurred and drowsy. "Bring. I want to hold."
"Yes?"
the Meiji asked.
"What is it you wish, Khaleesi?"
"Bring me egg. Dragon's egg, please."
Her lashes turned to lead, and she was too weary to hold them up. When she woke the third time, a shaft of golden sunlight was pouring through the smoke hole of the tent, and her arms were wrapped around a dragon's egg. It was the pale one, its scales the color of buttercream, vein with walls of gold and bronze, and Danny could feel the heat of it. Beneath her bed silks, a fine sheen of perspiration covered her bare skin. Dragon dew, she thought. Her fingers trailed lightly across the surface of the shell, tracing the wisps of gold, and deep in the stone she felt something twist and stretch in response. It did not frighten her. All her fear was gone, burned away. Danny touched her brow. Under the film of sweat, her skin was cool to the touch, her fever gone. She made herself sit. There was a moment of dizziness and the deep ache between her thighs, yet she felt strong. Her maids came running at the sound of her voice. "Water," she told them. "A flagon of water, cold as you can find it, and fruit, I think. Dates." "As you say, Khaleesi." "I want Sir Jorah," she said, standing. Jiqui brought a sand-silk robe and draped it over her shoulders. "And a warm bath, and Miramar's door, and—" Memory came back to her, all at once, and she faltered. "Khal Drogo," she forced herself to say, watching their faces with dread. "Is he—" "The Khal lives," Ira answered quietly. Yet Danny saw a darkness in her eyes when she said the words, and no sooner had she spoken Then she rushed away to fetch water. She turned to Doria. Tell me. I shall bring Sajara, the Lysine girl said, bowing her head and fleeing the tent. Jiqui would have run as well, but Danny caught her by the wrist and held her captive. What is it? I must know. Drogo and my child. Why had she not remembered the child until now? My son, Rago, where is he? I want him. Her handmaiden lowered her eyes. The boy, he did not live, Khaleesi. Her face was a frightened whisper. Danny released her wrist. My son is dead, she thought, as Jiqui left the tent. She had known somehow. She had known since she woke the first time to Jiqui's tears. No, she had known before she woke. Her dream came back to her, sudden and vivid, and she remembered the tall man with the copper skin and the long silver-gold braid bursting into flame. She should weep, she knew. Yet her eyes were dry as ash. She had wept in her dream, and the tears had turned to steam on her cheeks. All the grief has been burned out of me, she told herself. She felt sad, and yet she could feel Rago receding from her, as if he had never been. Sajara and Miramaz Dua entered a few moments later, and found Danny standing over the other dragon's eggs, the two still in their chest. It seemed to her that they felt as hot as the one she had slept with, which was passing strange. Sajara, come here, she said. She took his hand and placed it on the black egg with the scarlet swirls. What do you feel?
Shell, hard as rock.
The knight was wary.
Scales.
Heat?
No, cold stone.
He took his hand away.
Princess, are you well? Should you be up, weak as you are?
Weak? I am strong, Jara. To please him, she reclined on a pile of cushions. Tell me how my child died.
He never lived, my princess. The women say...
He faltered, and Danny saw how the flesh hung loose on him and the way he limped when he moved. Tell me. Tell me what the women say. He turned his face away. His eyes were haunted.
They say the child was...
She waited, but Sajara could not say it. His face grew dark with shame. He looked half a corpse himself.
Monstrous!
Miramaz Dua finished for him. The knight was a powerful man, yet Danny understood in that moment that the Meiji was stronger and crueler and infinitely more dangerous.
Twisted. I drew him forth myself. He was scaled like a lizard, blind, with the stub of a tail and small leather wings like the wings of a bat. When I touched him, the flesh sloughed off the bone, and inside he was full of grave worms and the stink of corruption. He had been dead for years.
Darkness, Danny thought, the terrible darkness sweeping up behind to devour her. If she looked back, she was lost. My son was alive and strong when Sajara carried me into this tent, she said. I could feel him kicking, fighting to be born.
That may be as it may be,
answered Miramaz Dua.
Yet the creature that came forth from your womb was as I said. Death was in that tent, Khaleesi.
Only shadows, Sir Jorah asked,
but Danny could hear the doubt in his voice.
I saw, Meiji, I saw you alone, dancing with the shadows.
The grave casts long shadows, Iron Lord,
Miri said.
Long and dark, and in the end, no light can hold them back.
Sajara had killed her son, Danny knew. He'd done what he did for love and loyalty. Yet he had carried her into a place no living man should go, and fed her baby to the darkness. He knew it, too.
the grey face, the hollow eyes, the limp. "The shadows have touched you too, Sir Jorah," she told him. The knight made no reply. Danny turned to the god's wife. "You warned me that only death could pay for life. I thought you meant the horse."
"No,"
Miramar's Dua said.
"That was a lie. You told yourself. You knew the place."
"Had she? Had she? If I look back, I'm lost." "The price was paid," Danny said. "The horse, my child, Quarro, Kotho, Hago, Kaholo. The price was paid, and paid, and paid." She rose from her cushions. "Where is Khal Drogo? Show him to me. God's wife, Meiji, blood mange, whatever you are, show me Khal Drogo. Show me what I bought with my son's life."
"As you command, Khaleesi," the old woman said. "Come, I will take you to him."
Danny was weaker than she knew. Sir Jorah slipped an arm around her and helped her stand.
"A time and office later, my princess," he said quietly.
"I would see him now, Sir Jorah." After the dimness of the tent, the world outside was blinding bright. The sun burned like molten gold, and the land was seared and empty. Her handmaids waited with fruit and wine and water, and Jogo moved close to help Sir Jorah support her. Ego and Rakaro stood behind. The glare of sun on sand made it hard to see more, until Danny raised her hand to shade her eyes. She saw the ashes of a fire, a few score horses milling listlessly and searching for a bite of grass, a scattering of tents and bedrolls. A small crowd of children had gathered to watch her, and beyond she glimpsed women going about their work, and withered old men staring at the flat blue sky with tired eyes, swatting feebly at blood flies. A count might show 100 people, no more. Where the other 40,000 had made their camp, only the wind and dust lived now. "Drogo's Khalasar is gone," she said.
"A Khal who cannot ride is no Khal," said Jogo.
"The Dothraki follow only the strong," Sir Jorah said. "I'm sorry, my princess, there was no way to hold them. Ko Pono left first, naming himself Khal Pono, and many followed him. Jago was not long to do the same. The rest slipped away night by night in large bands and small. There are a dozen new Khalasars on the Dothraki Sea, where once there was only Drogo's."
"The old remain," said Ego, "the frightened, the weak, and the sick. And we who swore we remain."
"They took Khal Drogo's herds, Khaleesi," Rakaro said. "We were too few to stop them. It is the right of the strong to take from the weak. They took many slaves as well, the Khals and yours. Yet they left some few."
"Iroa?" asked Danny, remembering the frightened child she had saved outside the city of the Lamb Men.
"Mago seized her, who is Khal Jago's blood rider now," said Jogo. "He mounted her high and low and gave her to his Khal, and Jago gave her to his other blood riders. They were six. When they were done with her, they cut her throat. It was her fate, Khaleesi," said Ego.
"If I look back, I'm lost."
"It was a cruel fate," Danny said, "yet not so cruel as Mago's will be, I promise you that, by the old gods and the new, by the lamb god and the horse god and every god that lives. I swear it by the mother of mountains and the womb of the world. Before I am done with them, Mago and Kojako will plead for the mercy they showed Iroa."
The Dothraki exchanged uncertain glances.
"Khaleesi," the handmaid Iri explained, as if to a child, "Jako is a Khal now, with 20,000 riders at his back."
She lifted her head. "And I am Daenerys Stormborn, Daenerys of House Targaryen, of the blood of Aegon the Conqueror, and Maegor the Cruel, and old Valyria before them. I am the dragon's daughter, and I swear to you, these men will die screaming.
Now bring me to Khal Drogo. He was lying on the bare, red earth, staring up at the sun. A dozen blood flies had settled on his body, though he did not seem to feel them. Danny brushed them away and knelt beside him. His eyes were wide open, but he did not see, and she knew at once that he was blind. When she whispered his name, he did not seem to hear. The wound on his breast was as healed as it ever would be, the scar that covered it grey and red and hideous. "Why is he out here alone, in the sun?" she asked him.
"Well, he seemed to like the warmth, princess," Sir Jorah said. "His eyes follow the sun, though he does not see it. He can walk, after a fashion. He will go where you lead him, but no further. He will eat if you put food in his mouth, drink if you dribble water on his lips."
Danny kissed her sun and stars gently on the brow, and stood to face Mirah Mazdur. "Your spells are costly, Meji."
"He lives," said Mirah Mazdur. "You asked for life. You paid for life."
"This is not life. For one who was as Drogo was, his life was laughter and meat roasting over a fire pit and a horse between his legs. His life was an arrack in his hand and his bells ringing in his hair as he rode to meet an enemy. His life was his blood riders and me and the son I was to give him." Mirah Mazdur made no reply. "When will he be as he was?" Danny demanded.
"When the sun rises in the west and sets in the east," said Mirah Mazdur. "When the seas go dry and mountains blow in the wind like leaves. When your womb quickens again and you bear a living child. Then he will return, and not before."
Danny gestured at Sir Jorah and the others. "Leave us. I would speak with this Meji alone." Mormont and the Dothraki withdrew. "You knew," Danny said when they were gone. She ached inside and out, but her fury gave her strength. "You knew what I was buying, and you knew the price. And yet you let me pay it."
"It was wrong of them to burn my temple," the heavy, flat-nosed woman said placidly. "That angered the great shepherd."
"This was no God's work," Danny said coldly.
"If I look back, I am lost.
You cheated me. You murdered my child within me."
"The stallion who mounts the world will burn no cities now. His Khalasar shall trample no nations into dust."
"I spoke for you," she said, anguished. "I saved you."
"Save me?"
the Lazarine woman spat.
"Three riders had taken me, not as a man takes a woman, but from behind as a dog takes a bitch. The fourth was in me when you rode past. How then did you save me? I saw my God's house burn. What I had healed, good men beyond counting. My home they burned as well. And in the street I saw piles of heads. I saw the head of a baker who made my bread. I saw the head of a boy I had saved from dead-eye fever only 3 moons past. I heard children crying as the riders drove them off with their whips. Tell me again what you saved."
"Your life." Mirah Mazdur laughed cruelly.
"Look to your Khal and see what life is worth when all the rest is gone."
Danny called out for the men of her cars and bid them take Mirah Mazdur and bind her hand and foot. But the Meji smiled at her as they carried her off, as if they shared a secret. A word, and Danny could have her head off. Yet then what would she have? A head? If life was worthless, what was death? They led Khal Drogo back to her tent, and Danny commanded them to fill a tub, and this time there was no blood in the water. She bathed him herself, washing the dirt and the dust from his arms and chest, cleaning his face with a soft cloth, soaping his long black hair and combing the knots and tangles from it until it shone again, as she remembered. It was well past dark before she was done, and Danny was exhausted. She stopped for drink and food, but it was all she could do to nibble at a fig and keep down a mouthful of water. Sleep would have been a release, but she had slept enough, too long, in truth. She owed this night to Drogo, for all the nights that had been, and yet might be. The memory of their first ride was with her, when she led him out into the darkness. For the Dothraki believed that all things of importance in a man's life must be done beneath the open sky. She told herself that there were powers stronger than hatred, and spells older and truer than any the Magi had learned in Ashai. The night was black and moonless, but overhead a million stars burned bright. She took that for an omen. No soft blanket of grass welcomed them here, only the hard, dusty ground, bare and strewn with stones. No trees stirred in the wind, and there was no stream to soothe her fears with the gentle music of water. Danny told herself that the stars would be enough. "Remember, Drogo," she whispered. "Remember our first ride together, the day we wed? Remember the night we made Rago, with the Kalasar all around us and your eyes on my face? Remember how cool and clean the water was in the womb of the world? Remember my sun and stars? Remember and come back to me." The birth had left her too raw and torn to take him inside of her, as she would have wanted. But Doria had taught her other ways. Danny used her hands, her mouth, her breasts. She raked him with her nails and covered him with kisses and whispered and prayed and told him stories. And by the end, she had bathed him with her tears. Yet Drogo did not feel or speak or rise. And when the bleak dawn broke over an empty horizon, Danny knew he was truly lost to her. "When the sun rises in the west and sets in the east," she said sadly. "When the seas go dry and mountains blow in the wind like leaves, when my womb quickens again and I bear a living child, then you will return, my sun and stars, and not before." "Never," the darkness cried. "Never, never, never." Inside the tent, Danny found a cushion, soft silk stuffed with feathers. She clutched it to her breasts as she walked back out to Drogo, to her sun and stars. "If I look back, I'm lost." It hurt even to walk, and she wanted to sleep. To sleep and not to dream. She knelt, kissed Drogo on the lips, and pressed the cushion down across his face. Tyrion.
"They of my son," Tywin Lannister said.
"They do, my lord."
The messenger's voice was dulled by exhaustion. On the breast of his torn surcoat, the brindled boar of Crakehall was half obscured by dried blood. "One of your sons," Tyrion thought. He took a sip of wine and said not a word, thinking of Jaime. When he lifted his arm, pain shot through his elbow, reminding him of his own brief taste of battle. He loved his brother, but he would not have wanted to be with him in the Whispering Wood for all the gold in Castle Rock. His lord father's assembled captains and bannermen had fallen very quiet as the courier told his tale. The only sound was the crackle and hiss of the log burning in the hearth at the end of the long, draughty common room. After the hardships of the long, relentless drive south, the prospect of even a single night in an inn
had cheered Tyrion mightily, though he rather wished it had not been this inn again, with all its memories. His father had set a grueling pace, and it had taken its toll. Men wounded in the battle kept up as best they could, or were abandoned to fend for themselves. Every morning they left a few more by the roadside, men who went to sleep, never to wake. Every afternoon a few more collapsed along the way, and every evening a few more deserted, stealing off into the dusk. Tyrion had been half tempted to go with them. He had been upstairs enjoying the comforts of a feather bed and the warmth of Shay's body beside him, when his squire had woken him to say that a rider had arrived with dire news of River Run. So it had all been for nothing. The rush south, the endless forced marches, the bodies left beside the road, all for naught. Robb Stark had reached River Run days and days ago.
"How could this happen?" Sir Harry Swift moaned. "How? Even after the Whispering Wood you had River Run ringed in iron, surrounded by a great host? What madness made Sir Jaime decide to split his men into three separate camps? Surely he knew how vulnerable that would leave them."
"Better than you, you chinless craven," Tyrion thought. Jaime might have lost River Run, but it angered him to hear his brother slandered by the likes of Swift, a shameless lickspittle, whose greatest accomplishment was marrying his equally chinless daughter to Sir Kevin, and thereby attaching himself to the Lannisters. "I would have done the same," his uncle responded, a good deal more calmly than Tyrion might have.
"You have never seen a River Run, Sir Aris, or you would know that Jaime had little choice in the matter. The castle is situated at the end of the point of land where the Tumblestone flows into the Red Fork of the Trident. The rivers form two sides of a triangle, and when danger threatens, the Tullys open their sluice gates upstream to create a wide moat on the third side, turning River Run into an island. The walls rise sheer from the water, and from the towers the defenders have a commanding view of the opposite shores for many leagues around. To cut off all the approaches, a besieger must need place one camp north of the Tumblestone, one south of the Red Fork, and a third between the rivers west of the moat. There is no other way. None."
"Sir Kevin speaks truly, my lords," the courier said. "We'd built palisades of sharpened stakes around the camps, yet it was not enough, not with no warning, and the rivers cutting us off from each other. They came down on the north camp first. No one was expecting an attack. Mark Piper had been raiding our supply trains, but he had no more than 50 men. Sir Jaime had gone out to deal with them the night before. Well, with what he thought was them. We were told the Stark host was east of the Green Fork, marching south."
"And your outriders?"
Sir Gregor Clegane's face might have been hewn from rock. The fire in the hearth gave a somber orange cast to his skin and put deep shadows in the hollows of his eyes.
"They saw nothing? They gave you no warning?"
The blood-stained messenger shook his head.
"Our outriders had been vanishing. Mark Piper's work, we thought. The ones who did come back had seen nothing."
"A man who sees nothing has no use for his eyes," the mountain declared. "Cut them out and give them to your next outrider. Tell him you hope that four eyes might see better than two, and if not, the man after him will have six."
Lord Tywin Lannister turned his face to study Sir Gregor. Tyrion saw a glimmer of gold as the light shone off his father's pupils, but he could not have said whether the look was one of approval or disgust. Lord Tywin was oft quiet in council, preferring to listen before he spoke, a habit Tyrion himself tried to emulate. Yet this silence was uncharacteristic even for him, and his wine was untouched.
"You say they came at night," Sir Kevin prompted.
The man gave a weary nod.
The Blackfish led the van, cutting down our sentries and clearing away the palisades for the main assault. By the time our men knew what was happening, riders were pouring over the ditch banks and galloping through the camp with swords and torches in hand. I was sleeping in the west camp between the rivers. When we heard the fighting and saw the tents being fired, Lord Brax led us to the rafts, and we tried to pole across. But the current pushed us downstream, and the Tollies started flinging rocks at us, with the catapults on their walls. I saw one raft smashed to kindling, and three others overturned, men swept into the river and drowned. And those who did make it across found the Starks waiting for them on the river bank. Sir Clement Brax wore a silver and purple tabard, and the look of a man who cannot comprehend what he has just heard. "My lord, father." "Sorry, my lord," the messenger said. "Lord Brax was clad in plate and mail when his raft overturned. He was very gallant." "He was a fool," Tyrion thought, swirling his cup and staring down into the winy depths. Crossing a river at night on a crude raft, wearing armor, with an enemy waiting on the other side, that was gallantry. He would take cowardice every time. He wondered if Lord Brax had felt especially gallant, as the weight of his steel pulled him under the black water. The camp between the rivers was overrun as well, the messenger was saying. While we were trying to cross, more Starks swept in from the west, two columns of armoured horse. I saw Lord Umber's giant in chains and the Malister Eagle, but it was the boy who led them, with a monstrous wolf running at his side. I wasn't there to see it, but it said the beast killed four men and ripped apart a dozen horses. Our spearmen formed up a shield wall and held against their first charge, but when the Tullys saw them engaged, they opened the gates of River Run, and Titus Blackwood led a sortie across the drawbridge and took them in the rear. "God save us," Lord Lefford swore. Great John Umber fired the siege towers we were building, and Lord Blackwood found Sir Edmure Tully in chains among the other captives and made off with them all. Our south camp was under the command of Sir Fawley Prester. He retreated in good order when he saw that the other camps were lost, with 2,000 spears and as many bowmen. But the Tyrushy sellsword, who led his free riders, struck his banners and went over to the foe. "Curse the man!" His Uncle Kevin sounded more angry than surprised. "I warned Jamie not to trust that one. A man who fights for coin is loyal only to his purse." Lord Tywin wove his fingers together under his chin. Only his eyes moved as he listened. His bristling, golden side whiskers framed a face so still it might have been a mask. But Tyrion could see tiny beads of sweat dappling his father's shaven head.
"How could it happen?" Sir Harry Swift wailed again. "Sir Jamie taken, the siege broken. This is a catastrophe."
Sir Adam Marbrand said,
"I'm sure we're all grateful to you for pointing out the obvious, Sir Harry. The question is, what should we do about it?"
"What can we do? Jamie's host is all slaughtered, all taken, all put to flight. And the Starks and the Tullys sit squarely across our line of supply. We are cut off from the west. They can march on Castle Rock if they so choose, and what's to stop them? My lords, we are beaten. We must sue for peace."
"Peace?" Tyrion swirled his wine thoughtfully, took a deep draught, and hurled his empty cup to the floor, where it shattered into 1,000 pieces.
"There's your peace, Sir Arias. My sweet nephew broke it for good and all when he decided to ornament the Red Keep with Lord Eddard's head. You'll have an easier time drinking wine from that cup than you will convincing Robb Stark to make peace now. He's winning. Or hadn't you noticed?"
"Two battles do not make a war," Sir Adam insisted. "We are far from lost. I should welcome the chance to try my own steel against this dark boy."
"Perhaps they would consent to a truce and allow us to trade our prisoners for theirs," offered Lord Lefford. "Unless they trade 3-for-1, we still come out light on those scales," Tyrion said acidly. And what are we to offer for my brother? Lord Eddard's rotting head?
I had heard that Queen Cersei has the Hand's daughters, Lefford said hopefully. If we give the